ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
If you woke up tomorrow and found yourself Prime Minister, what would you do? How would you run Australia? What's your plan for energy, for housing, for the economy? The Economy Stupid has a three-part series talking about what Australia could become if we had the courage to choose it. Search for The Economy Stupid and look out for Choose Your Own Australia. Find it where you get your podcasts and the ABC Listen app.
Hi, this is Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor. We have pored over the archives to bring you a special summer compilation of your favourite stories from this year. It's all about parents today. Even if you don't have kids, there's a lot of reflections in here about the way you were raised as well. You'll hear about what's driving a rise in home births and how fathering, not fatherhood, has changed in Australia over the past century. More on that distinction in language coming up. Plus, how comedian Matt O'Kine has totally changed his priorities and how he thinks about money since becoming a dad in My Two Cents. How much do you think about pulling a trigger before you post something online? I know there is a ton of stuff that I wish I'd thought about more. There are blog posts, there's photos of my kids and just dumb stuff, a whole library of my own personal embarrassing digital history floating around out there. So when we post photos of our kids, we're writing the first chapters of their digital history. And there's a lot riding on getting it right. And that line of what's appropriate and what's not is shifting. Even people who had strict rules around what they would or wouldn't post about their kids are now saying they wish they'd never shared anything at all. These days, it's not just people with big followings who need to watch out for unintended consequences once an image is online. And I would love to hear from you on this. Do you share your kids in the same way now than you did when they were really little? Or if you have a few kids, how's your thinking on this changed? Do you regret sharing things online? Have you had a digital about face and how did it go? With me is Roisin Tarrant, a content creator. She makes videos about her life as a mum of three with over 300,000 followers across TikTok and Instagram. Roisin, you make parenting and mum content. Tell me about the rules you originally set for yourself about sharing photos of your son.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I actually started my account as a renovation account. So this was well before I had children. And so it wasn't really on my mind. Then I had listened to a few podcasts here and there about how people share their kids online. And when he was born, because my account was really about my home, he wasn't really centered in it. And then I kind of realized, gosh, I really like this mum stuff. And so I started to share a little bit more about my mum journey. And I never centered him in my content, but I didn't blur his face out. Then when he was about 6 months old, I thought, okay, he's starting to become more recognisable. And so I kind of just cut him out of my content completely. And then if he was around, I would blur his face. And then I got pregnant with twins and decided, cool, I'm just going to replicate exactly what I had done last time. So when they were babies, they were around and all of that kind of thing. Then they turned 6 months and I thought, that's the end of that. But yeah, I've definitely changed my tune on that a little bit.
So twin content goes off on social media.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. And that was probably the catalyst for me to change my mind because I was sharing this content that, you know, it's objectively cute. And I think 99.9% of the people consuming it had great intentions and just thought cute babies. But the 1% was too much for me.
So this is people sharing your content on their own platforms. Is that what you mean?
No, liking, saving, just viewing in general, you know, millions and millions of views. That's too many people seeing my kids, in my opinion.
What was there a particular moment that stuck out for you where you kind of realised you'd lost control of those images?
I think I looked at the analytics of the post and I saw one of them had something like 4,500 saves. And I thought, yuck. I just don't like that. And I just realised there's no reason for anyone to be saving that video of my kids. And that was my fault that I put that out into the universe to be saved.
Is that, like, had the horse bolted? Have you gone back and pulled those things down?
I have pulled down so much stuff and I still to this day, you know, I'll get memories of a year ago today or 2 years ago you posted this and I'm archiving stuff every day. And it's interesting because, like I said, I never featured my kids prominently in my content, and I will still find things where, you know, they'll be in the background of something and I'm having to pull stuff down all the time.
So as part of this sort of awakening process, you are a social media person. You made a video about it.
Yeah.
And you kind of talked to your followers about saying you'd made a mistake. Why did you address it in such a public way?
I think because I get a lot of questions about why I don't show my kids. I predominantly just don't film them, but on the rare occasion that they might be in the background, I will blow their faces out. So I do go to quite an extent not to have them seen. And every time a video goes up where they are blurred out, I get a lot of backlash of people saying, like, why do you blow your kids out? It's not that big of a deal. Do you think you're a celebrity? And
you're like, why do you care so much about my kids?
Yeah, and I think that that kind of rhetoric kind of just reinforces my beliefs on this topic. But also I think it's just, I wish I had have seen more videos like this as I was growing my following, because it just wasn't the discussion. And I just thought, that's a problem for really big influencers. It's not a problem for me. You know, I just had 5,000 followers at the time or something like that. And the way that the algorithms work now is you could have 300 followers, but if you have a public account, especially on TikTok, that algorithm is crazy. You know, you had 10 million people watching a video. So I think it's just, you can lose control of your own content very quickly.
You are listening to Life Matters here on Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor, and we're talking about when you're sharing your life online, what happens when you want to change your mind and pull some of that back, especially if you have kids. If this is something that you've thought about or changed your mind on, how much you share about your family members, I'd really love to know what went into making that decision. I'm also joined by Nick Carra, who's the director of the Centre for Digital Cultures and Societies at the University of Queensland. Nick, what do you think about Roisin's story? Is this sort of regret common?
Yeah, I think it's totally common. And I think it, like, I guess what I'm thinking about is it's the millennials having children, right? It's like the generation that was the first generation to grow up on the internet. And the millennials were kind of messy on the internet, you know, in our teens and 20s. And so now we're having kids and we have this kind of lived experience of it. And we're like, oh, wait a second. Because we're thinking about it often in terms of our own lives. Like, a lot of us are digging back deep into our, you know, Facebook, or, do you know, I remember once going and hunting for my old MySpace profile to make sure that it had absolutely been deleted.
your top eight friends.
Yeah. You're
going to update that.
You know, my photo bucket and whatever, you know. So you sort of have this own experience of it, and now you have kids. And so you kind of really then start to contemplate all of that with your kids from an early age.
I definitely know in myself, my own life, and the people who I speak to, there's this sort of resounding relief that we didn't have social media when we were kids, and when we were even young adults for a lot of us. And what we're realizing is that our kids sort of never got to opt out of this.
Right. But I also think, like, maybe kids growing up now, like, you know, we know, like, I don't know, Gen Z, they're probably way more careful than the millennials were. And so they're probably going to have less to go back and delete, because they've grown up in a world that's also told them you'll be super visible on the internet for a very long time, be very, very careful. Whereas the millennials, when social media blew up in the mid-noughties through to the mid-20s, they weren't hearing that message. They were just, they never thought, like, the future would show up on the internet, or their parents would show up on the internet, or anything like that.
It did feel like a closed space, and there was a safety in that, but we're realising that it's really permanent and really enduring. I'm really keen to know, if you've set rules around how you share your kids on social media, have you had to tell friends and grandparents about those rules as well? And how have you communicated that to them? One text says, I haven't posted pictures of my daughter's face on social media since she was born a year ago. This choice was made because I try to remain cognizant of her humanity above all else, and to be mindful that she's a person first and always, rather than a source of entertainment or content. I know that for me personally, that would be a slippery slope of posting things that were cute and funny at the time, or according to my judgment in the moment, but which might end up compromising my sense of integrity around holding her best interests at heart and being sensitive to and protecting her little human self. Such a thoughtful text, Roisin. What the early rules that you had around when babies are really small, they're very unique, but they're also, in a sense, a little baby and
exactly,
not themselves.
Yeah.
That was part of your original reasoning.
Totally. That was so much of where I came from, is I thought, no one's going to recognise my three-year-old if they see a photo of him as a newborn. And I do still stand by that decision, that nobody out in the wild would recognize my children from social media. And that was a really, really big thing for me. I think I had an instance where we put him in a daycare and someone sent me a message and said, oh, has your son just started at X daycare?
Oh,
I think he's started in the same room as my child. And I just had this sinking feeling of, if I hadn't have shared his name on social media, that connection would never have been made. So that's kind of why I like to share these things, because I thought I was doing the right thing. And there is still so many things I would go back and do differently. I wish I had have given my kids pseudonyms. Like, I wish I hadn't have put their legal names on the internet. And if you follow me now, you'll never hear me saying their names anymore. So it's been, you know, probably 8 months since I've said their names online, but they're out there now. If someone really wants to know, they'll find out. So I think that, and when I posted my video talking about all my reasons behind not sharing my kids, one of the biggest bits of feedback I got was, how do I talk to grandparents about my decision of sharing kids online? Because nobody, oh, I'm not going to say nobody, but most people don't share with any ill intent. They share because these little people are beautiful and the lights of our lives, and we're so proud of them. And I think it can be really hard to talk to people. I definitely have gotten a lot of people that just say, you're so over the top, you're overreacting, it's not that big of a deal. So I think respecting those decisions that parents make for their own kids is really important as well.
How did you have those conversations with your loved ones?
Well, we're very lucky because we have a public profile that I'm very open about not sharing my kids. I feel like it just kind of trickled down that, oh, you know, Roshan and Zach don't want their kids on the internet. And I think especially because we do have a public profile, something that I've noticed is when you intentionally keep something private, it makes it more enticing for people to seek out. So when, you know, you try to keep your children off the internet, people will try and find ways to find photos of them, which is very scary. And once again, reiterates the point of why I've made the decision that I've made.
Nick, what might be going on there, do you think?
Like, I think some of it, you know, before you leap to the small percentage of people who probably have very creepy reasons, you know what I mean? A lot of it's just the weird parasocial ambience of digital life. Like, we just sort of know a lot about strangers and sometimes know a lot about our colleagues and friends' lives that we only know because of this flow of stuff that's going through social media. And so I think some of it would be people hunting around, but some of it would be just they've kind of picked up all of these little details about the rhythm of your week and, you know, yeah, who your kids' names are.
Totally.
And, you know, where you drop them off and all of that kind of stuff. And then they just kind of bring it up in conversation and we're like, whoa, wait a second. Like, this kind of collision between the ambient background of our digital worlds and our actual lived experiences kind of freaks us out sometimes.
Yeah. The other thing I wanted to bring up was this idea of TikTok as one platform, and the fact that the early social media sites were very much about a closed group with people that you knew in real life. And we shared things subconsciously, kind of knowing that those were the rules there. We're hearing Roshan talking about TikTok stuff going crazy. How is, there's probably a lot of people who are like, no thanks, don't want to be on TikTok. But the truth is that the way that it works is filtering through to other social sites.
That's right. So Instagram, you know, starts off as a sort of social networking site. So the whole idea is you're following and following if others are following you, and you kind of know them and you kind of know who your followers are. And then as you build up that audience, it's like you're making the choice to build a bigger audience and you're kind of aware of it. Whereas TikTok sort of looks like that, but it's not like that. It's an entertainment economy kind of platform. And so it's not about who follows who and who knows who. It's about finding content and it's very content hungry to keep feeding into the For You page feed. And so it's going to find all of these people who have very low followers and put their video and expose it to like enormous audiences all of a sudden. And so I think a lot of people who kind of blow up on TikTok are unprepared for the visibility of being a creator.
On the text line, Bill says, social media exists for one reason, the company's profit. So Nick, how is what we share online dictated by the companies that run these platforms?
So these platforms basically are extremely content hungry. They want, you know, to make a profit, they have to keep you in the feed scrolling for as long as possible because it's your attention that is the product that they can sell to advertisers. And to keep you scrolling, they need more content and they want to get that content as cheaply as possible. They want to pay for it. And so TikTok has really changed the game here because it's massively diffused or distributed who the creators are of content. And so it's created an extraordinary number of people who are creating volumes of content content to smaller audiences that then are getting fed into the For You page and blowing up. Whereas something like Instagram had a sort of smaller number of very high profile influencers who are producing content. And so it's like drawing a lot of us into this creator economy, these kind of forms of visibility that's new. And so TikTok has really dramatically changed the whole landscape, because now Instagram wants to operate like that, YouTube wants to operate like that. And so all of a sudden, you have many more people who are kind of finding themselves, either by design or by accident, a creator on these platforms.
So, Roisin, you were never profiting off your kids directly. They weren't part of brand collaborations. You weren't sort of a mum influencer. Mm. You were a renovator. Mm-hmm. How have you pulled away the part of TikTok that you could monetize, if any, from your family now that this has shifted for you?
Yeah, I definitely would call myself a mum content creator, but I share my motherhood and not my children. So I share my experience as a woman with three young kids. I am a career woman. I'm a creative. And that to me is very separate to my children. You know, I might share the things like how I get everyone's lunchboxes prepped in the day, or my breastfeeding journey with twins, or my fertility journey, and all of those things are my stories to tell. They are, you know, that's my prerogative to put that information online, and I have complete control of how, because I am the creator and I produce the content, I have complete control of the message that I put out there. I don't have control once it's out there of the response. And I think that's probably the biggest learning for me, is I put a video up once where I was talking about my two little girls, and I mentioned their names in the video, and it went completely viral, and people started commenting on their names, you know, really derogatory comments about what I had called my kids. And I thought, like, they just don't need to see that kind of content on the internet when they grow up. They don't need to see people making that kind of comments about them. And I think people really dehumanize creators that they see through algorithms, you know, on the For You page and even on Instagram. They don't think, oh, this is just a suburban mum with three kids, like going to work, doing her best. They think, you know, this is just entertainment for me and I'm going to say whatever first thing comes out of my head.
Nick, whenever we have conversations like this, I always think, are human brains incompatible with the size of the audience that we can reach on social media?
Or like the experience you're describing, our brain's kind of incompatible with the forms of sociality where we're encountering these very intimate stories from ordinary people who are sharing these stories about their lives. And in one way, the kind of stories you tell, Roisin, are really kind of important to other mums like you who want to, you know, there's something very important there. But in another way, they're kind of being exposed to this huge audience of strangers who can then just kind of intervene in your life in really intimate and upsetting kinds of ways. And like on both sides of that, both the creator side and the audience side, we're not prepared for it. And these platforms are kind of tuned to exploit our limbic system, you know, not our kind of, you know, that kind of instinctive part of our brain, not the reflective, caring part of our brain sometimes.
Roisin, so your kids are still little, they're little kids. These probably aren't big conversations you're having yet, but when they're old enough to understand the sort of process and the decision-making that you've gone through, what do you hope they learn from your example?
I hope they learn that I just put them first, that they were my number one priority, and that I was never putting, you know, I believe that no one has the right to earn money through social media. I have another job. I have another career. I don't rely on this as my way to support my family. And that I would have, you know, I will go and work at Coles. I will go and do anything that I need to do if it means keeping them safe.
Thanks to you both for sharing your experience and insights today. Roisin Tarrant is a content creator. She makes videos about her life as a mum of three on TikTok and Instagram. You can look up G Bungalow Roisin if you want to follow along. And Nick Carra, the director of the Centre for Digital Cultures and Societies at the University of Queensland. And you've been sharing your thoughts on this as well. A really interesting insight from a paediatric ethicist. Sharenting is a huge issue for sick children and those with a disability. This is a breach of your child's confidentiality, which you as a parent hold in trust. Anonymizing your child is impossible. The linkages are limitless and you may negatively affect your child's future. Real food for thought there. Well, stick with me here on Life Matters on ABC Radio National, because coming up, what's behind the growing rate of home births and is it safe?
She was warm, funny, every student's favourite teacher.
No one ever suspects a woman could do such a thing, especially one with kids.
The parents trusted her too.
I felt that the school was a safe place. If anything was to happen, there would be somebody there.
But it was all a smokescreen.
She was brainwashing us from the start.
The Favourite, a five-part investigation from Background Briefing. Search Background Briefing on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Giving birth at home used to be rare, and maybe something had happened more by accident than by choice. If you did it intentionally, people maybe raised an eyebrow a bit. They might have pigeonholed you as alternative. But that's changing, because since 2019, home births where you deliver your baby at home under the supervision of a midwife have doubled across Australia. Modern medicine has led to huge positives for women and their babies, and birth has become something that happens in hospitals as a default. So why are home births on the rise? Philippa Scott is the coordinator of Home Births Australia, and Alison Weatherstone is the chief midwife at the Australian College of Midwives. In just a tick, you'll hear about how home birthing is being used to fill vital gaps in maternity care. But what's it like to actually give birth at home? Maddie Waters is a Queensland mum of three. Maddie, who's in your family? Who are your kids?
Hi, I've got three kids. I've got two sons and a daughter. Their names are Monty, Kip and Rue.
Great names. You had a home birth recently with Rue. What led you to choose home birth this time around?
I had a really positive and empowering hospital birth with my first son. And with my second son, Kip, I was sent home after being in hospital for only 2 hours. I was given an ultimatum. I could either go home or they would break my waters to speed up labour, just because the midwife said my contractions weren't intensifying and she just didn't think I was progressing fast enough. So we packed up our bags and walked out, and we got down to the foyer, and I actually transitioned in the foyer and wanted to rip all my clothes off in the foyer. My partner, he grabbed a wheelchair and raced me back up to the birth suite, and my son was born in less than 2 minutes after arriving back in the birth suite. And there was something about being turned away from hospital for not doing good enough to kind of warrant their time when, in fact, I was about to have a baby in 10 minutes. It really affected me, and I just couldn't stop thinking about it. And I nearly felt guilty that it affected me so much, because nothing went wrong. Like, physically, I was fine. My baby was fine. And I didn't know why I felt this way and why it made me so upset. And so when I fell pregnant with my third child, my daughter Rue, I knew I had to take kind of some control over the situation. And I really felt the only way I was going to get autonomy and control and support in my birth was to do it at home.
And so that was an option that was actually available to you through the health system, which hasn't always been the case.
No, yeah, it hasn't. And I had a few friends who had had home births, and so I knew who to call. And, yeah, when I called the home birth midwives and I had that initial consultation, I burst into tears. I couldn't retell my story of my hospital birth without, feeling all those emotions. And I booked in the home birth then and there, and as soon as I booked it in, I felt this huge relief that I'd made the right decision and I was kind of always meant to have this baby at home.
So I love a birth story, but give me the abridged version. Like, how did it go with Rue?
It was so beautiful. All my births started the same way, just a little bit crampy after dinner, and I kind of knew that tonight was the night. I thought I'll get as much sleep as I can, went to bed early and was really surprised. I woke up at 1 a.m, had a pretty good sleep, and contractions were kind of starting, but I thought I'd play it cool and stay in bed until about 3, where I could no longer lie down. I woke up my partner, Joe, and he called the midwives, kind of let them know what was happening. We were just kind of working through it together. We'd done this before. Joe set up the birth pool, and I could hear the midwife walking along my veranda, and I said, Joe, I think I'm ready to push. And so I just hopped straight in the bath. I actually didn't even see my midwife. I had my eyes closed the whole time. I could just hear her voice behind me. And 10 minutes later, Rue was born. And probably my favourite part of the whole thing was they went and woke up my two boys and brought them in right after she was born. And so we had this beautiful moment as a family of five. And my three-year-old son, he was just patting me on the back, telling me what a good job I did. It was just really beautiful. And we just slunk off into bed after that. The midwives cleaned up everything. I felt so safe the whole time. Like, these midwives are so educated and, they just know exactly what they're doing. And, yeah, it was beautiful.
You're listening to Life Matters here on Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor, and that's Maddie Waters describing a beautiful, probably ideal home birth with her third baby after maybe having a traumatic experience at hospital with her first. Philippa Scott is the coordinator of Home Births Australia, which is the peak body advocating for this style of birth in Australia. Philippa, welcome to Life Matters. How common is that story that Maddie told of having a traumatic experience in hospital and then choosing to home birth after that?
Oh, well, thank you for having me, Tegan. It is extremely common. It's my story. It's the story of most of the women I've worked with over the past 22 years as a birth advocate and as a birth trauma specialist. It was the specific reason why my daughter chose to birth my granddaughter at home for her first birth, because she knew she didn't actually need to be exposed and have a traumatic experience the first time round. And unfortunately, of the women that I work with and the women that come to Home Birth Australia, a good 80 to 90% of the women who experience birth trauma don't experience it because of a catastrophic event, but because of obstetric violence, coercion, all those sorts of, feeling a lack of respect within the system.
A lot of reporting by the ABC done on that over the last couple of years. What else is driving up the numbers of home births in Australia? Because COVID must have played a role here.
Sure. When hospitals started saying that you can't have mum, you can't have a doula, you can't even potentially have your partner in there when you're giving birth, it made what is, like Maddie beautifully described, a family event. It turned that into something that women were required to do solo, which took us right back to the mid-19th century, where women were being forced to do it alone, and they were removed from everybody. And so women sort of went, well, hold on, I'm not doing this by myself. I don't want to be alone. I want to be supported. I want to have my tribe and my people. And so they started exploring their options and leaning into home birth as an option.
So publicly funded home births are available in all the states and territories except for Tasmania, which is a relatively recent evolution, if I'm not mistaken, because I know a decade or so ago, that wasn't really an option for many people in Australia.
No, it certainly wasn't. There was definitely some out there, particularly in South Australia and in New South Wales. But Queensland literally only brought it in this last year. They've been working on that. But if you're not within 35 minutes of the Sunshine Coast Hospital, then you're out. So, and Queensland's a lot bigger than that, as you might have No, so there are a lot of women who don't have access to that, and that's unacceptable. It really, and to be fair, that program, whilst it means well, it's not servicing most of the women who want it anyway. A lot of women are excluded from that program, not just because of geographical location.
You're listening to Life Matters here on Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor, and we're talking about home births as an option. They're increasing in popularity in Australia. They're also more available than they used to be. And I'd love to know if you've had one, if you want to share your experience. One person says, I'm all for home birth, but sometimes things can go horribly wrong if you're not sure that everything is in the right place. Another person is telling a story of having a perfectly healthy and regular pregnancy with their first child at 29, wanted to have a natural birth without intervention, and after an extremely long and traumatic birth, my beautiful big baby was taken away so I could get some rest. And this person talks about going into hemorrhage, and the midwife that was on shift in the hospital realised that, and this text says, if not for the fact that I was in hospital and for the vigilance of the midwife that came in to check on me, I would have died. So the stakes are so high here. Alison Weatherstone is the chief midwife at the Australian College of Midwives and is entering the chat. Alison, can you talk to me about the safety profile of home births, because that seems to be the biggest concern that people have when we're having this sort of conversation?
Yeah, thank you, Tegan. Thanks for having me. And also, I just wanted to acknowledge Maddie's experience and just her story. So thank you. We know that there are conflicting views around home birth out there, and home birth is often viewed as less safe. I think this is largely due to outdated perceptions. It's also a lack of understanding about midwifery-led care. And we did also hear about the dominance of hospital-based maternity systems in Australia from Philippa. There's also been a tendency to associate all birth with risk, which doesn't usually reflect the reality for many healthy pregnancies. So I think we've got a bit of work to do to change this perception. But certainly the Australian College of Midwives supports the choice of planned midwife attended birth at home as a safe option for women, especially with uncomplicated pregnancies. And I just wanted to touch on, there's been an Australian study, there's actually been a few, but that they found that planned home births for low-risk women had comparable safety outcomes to hospital births. And these included low rates of perinatal mortality, which is a key measure of safety and quality in maternity care. And I think women and families want to know that any care that they access is going to be safe. But we also know that women who plan a home birth have lower rates of intervention, and these are things like cesarean section, episiotomy, or an instrumental assisted birth, and they're more likely to have a normal vaginal birth and go on to successfully breastfeed. And I think there's also a lot of evidence now that tells us that women who plan a home birth are more likely to experience this respectful, continuity-based care and less likely to experience birth trauma, which we're also hearing a lot more about.
Philippa, do you want to pick that up? What would you like to see in terms of access around Australia?
Well, look, we're advocating for all choices for all women. And what we, you know, a big part of how we see that unfolding is that women could be, in fact, given an allocation of funds and given the opportunity to choose what care they would prefer. So whether she chooses to use that funding for a private hospital and an obstetrician, or whether she wants to have a home birth with an independent midwife, somebody not attached to the healthcare system, or whether she wants to use it within a hospital, either any of those is fine and come without judgment. What we want to see is for women to have the autonomy to be able to choose the care that is right for them and their circumstances. And every family will have different risk and assessments. And so, you know, if we go back to my daughter's story, she was a young mother of she gave birth at 20. She has she's neurodivergent. So for her, being in a hospital environment would cause her to have peaks in adrenaline and not feel comfortable enough to let go and give birth. And so she needed to have private midwives who she had chosen, that she fit with, that could facilitate her having a healthy birth. Because when we are not in a good psychological place, then our births inherently become more risky. And we know that to be true. So, you know, we want women to have the full access to all choices, no matter where they are, and no matter what their risk is. So women should be able to choose what they want to do, and then in combination with a midwife, choose whether that's appropriate for her, and allow the midwives to act in full autonomy. They're not obstetric handmaidens. They are a profession within their own right and should be able to exercise their professional capacity.
Also, Maddie, you've got three kids now. Maybe you don't want a fourth one, but if you had one, would you choose a home birth again?
Absolutely. But also in saying that, I would be guided by professionals in a medical sense. If it wasn't safe for me to have a home birth, I would be guided by them.
Follow the evidence. Thanks to Maddie Waters, a Queensland mum of three who gave birth to her daughter at home, Philippa Scott, coordinator of Home Births Australia, and Alison Weatherstone, chief midwife at the Australian College of Midwives. And thank you for your texts. One text says, I have four children, two born at home, two in a birthing suite at hospital, three born totally naturally with help and guidance from a midwife. A wonderfully rewarding set of experiences. Another says, I had my second child at home in 2000 and felt safe as I was within a 40-minute drive to the nearest hospital. Also had a great natural birth with my first. Was exquisite to wrap up in my own bed with partner and two beautiful children around me. Well, up next, it's something for the dads. The history of fathering in Australia. What's changed over the past century? Just indulge me for a second. Take a moment and think about your dad. What's he look like? What kind of memories does he feature in? And where's he absent? How does he compare to the stereotypical Aussie dad, whatever that looks like to you? Because Australian fathering is as diverse as the dads that span the country, and it's changed hugely over the past few generations. Now a group of researchers have set out to document the history of dadding across the past century. So, of course, I want to hear from dads today about how you dad. Did you look up to your father as a role model to emulate when you had kids, or are you doing things differently? Alistair Thompson is a historian at Monash University and one of the authors of Fathering an Australian History. He is also a proud dad, stepdad, and granddad. Alistair, firstly, who are you a dad to?
Thanks, Tegan, and thanks for having me on Life Matters. I've got a daughter, Lily, who's training to be a nurse at the moment and has got two kids of her own, and a son who's a psych nurse in Melbourne.
Talk to me about the title of this book here. Why did you choose the word fathering and not fatherhood?
Yeah, it's a good question, Tegan. Fatherhood is an institution. It's the institution of fatherhood. It's the expectations about what fathers should be and do. Fathering is what we actually do as dads. It's the act of fathering. It's how we look after our kids, what support we provide, and so on and so forth. And we thought the fathering for this book was a more important term because it's a book based upon fathers' life stories from letters, from diaries, from memoirs, and especially from oral history interviews conducted across the 20th century with Australian dads, but also with kids talking about their dads. And these are stories where people talk about how dads dadded, or whatever the word is, and how that shifted or didn't shift across the 20th century.
Dad is a verb. So tell me about what you saw shifting over that time.
Look, Australia's interesting. I mean, across the Western world, fathers across the 20th century have been primarily expected to be the breadwinner of the family. In Australia, Australia's quite distinctive because we institutionalised that with the basic wage in the early 20th century, which was basically set on the premise that a man's wage should be set so that they could keep a wife and three kids in reasonably frugal comfort. That was the quote. And that was the expectation. So wage settings were set so that men's wage was a family wage and women were paid much, much less, which meant that basically the expectation was that women would raise children. And so it structured in fathers as breadwinners and mothers as mothers and not as workers, although as we know, many women did work, and that shifts across the 20th century. So while men continue to be primary breadwinners across the 20th century, you get some really significant shifts in the second half of the century as married women increasingly work, as the economy requires two incomes in every family, but also as expectations about what men should do in families shift with second wave feminism in particular, beginning to argue that women should be out there working as well as raising kids, but also men should be more at home, playing a more active and engaged role in family life. And there's a tension between the expectation that you see in Bluey, for example, with Bluey's dad, Bandit, who's this extraordinary father, active, engaged, playful, spending a lot of time with his kids, But Bluey doesn't work. Well, he does work. He's got a job. He's an archaeologist. He digs up bones. but you don't see Bluey, Bandit rather, going off to work very often in that show. And that's the key tension for the 21st century dad. On the one hand, they're expected to be active and engaged fathers. On the other hand, the wage system and the welfare system, the nature of parental leave, all means that it's much more likely that mothers will be doing most of the raising children and that fathers will often become what we sometimes describe as secondary dads, playing a part-time role, weekends, after schools, whatever, but not really taking the major load of family life.
I'm nodding so furiously, Alistair. It feels like you're really describing the tension in so many families like my own and my peers and everything. The thing that really stood out to me in the book, though, is that there is this sense of a traditional early 20th century fatherhood trope, but there's always been men that broke the mold.
That's right. One of the lovely things about working with life stories is you realise that, yes, there are structural and systematic factors that shape what people do, what men and women do in families, and there are cultural expectations that change across time and also influence what we do. But actually, when it comes down to it, every family has to make its own decisions, and every father has to take responsibility for what they do. And there's some wonderful case studies. The one that really comes to mind to me is such an unexpected story. So Herman Mandel was a father of four small boys when his wife dies in the early 20th century. He's a painter and decorator. He's a working class man. There's no welfare support for a single dad in those days. He's got no choice but to continue working. And what usually happened for much of the 20th century was that men like that, widowed or separated, would either get married quickly so they had someone to raise the kids, they would farm the kids out to family members, or what often happened, the kids would end up in institutions. But Herman Mandel is extraordinary. He moves across town in Sydney to live in a street where Auntie Beryl is able to look after the infant son who's not yet at school. The other three boys are at school, and Herman learns to cook. He learns to look after the house. The boys learn to cook and help each other. And Herman is an extraordinary dad. He works hard, but he also, and there's a lovely story about the sons remembering how dad learned to make puddings, not just cook main meals, but puddings as well. And what's really interesting that Arthur, the youngest of the three boys who is at home with their dad, has this active dad who's engaged, who's got a working life, but also is fully engaged with raising his sons. And then when Arthur becomes a father in the 1930s and 1940s, he's really quite exceptional as a man of that generation. He's married, he's the primary breadwinner, but unlike many men of that generation, in an interview in the early 1980s, he remembered above all being a dad, and he remembered taking a really key role in changing nappies and bathing the kids and reading to his daughters. And my sense is that because that's what he'd grown up with, an active and engaged father, that was something that came to him naturally and which he did against the odds. And so that was pretty uncommon in the 1930s and 40s. But it's an example of, if you have a role model of a father who's actively engaged in family life, then you're more likely perhaps to become that father when you become a dad.
That is so beautiful. And it makes me think about, you sort of hear one of two things with parents, not just dads, where you either go, the way I was raised was wonderful and I want to give my children that, or the way I was raised was terrible and I'm going to do the opposite.
Absolutely right. I mean, the book is full because they're life stories and people are remembering their fathers and they're often thinking about how their father fathered and therefore as they become a dad, how they should do it. And that ranges from everything from domestic and family violence. And no, this is a story with a book with lots of wonderful stories, but it's also got a dark history because family violence is there right across the 20th century. It tends to get neglected or pushed under the carpet until late in the 20th century when it becomes both a personal and a political issue. But you've got, you know, men whose fathers were violent, dealing with, well, how do I break that pattern? And wonderful examples of men who do make conscious decisions not to be like their dads. You've also got, I mean, there's a really interesting thing, for example, in the 1930s, a lot of fathers are out of work, family life is tough, and the kids who grow up in the 30s, who become parents, become fathers or mothers in the 1950s and 60s, are determined to have family security in a way that they didn't have when they were growing up. And so there's a generation of young men who become fathers after World War II who are determined to be successful breadwinners and work really hard. And their kids who are growing up in the sort of 50s, 60s and 70s, on the one hand, have a lot of respect for their fathers, for the family security that they grew up in, but also they remember absent dads. They remember dads who are away long hours at work, often working on weekends, getting home after they're asleep and so on. And so when these men become dads in the 80s and 90s, they want to be different to their fathers. They want to be more active and engaged fathers. And at the same time, you've got second wave feminism giving them a model that, that, if you like, legitimizes that. But at the same time, the nature of work and of men's and women's pay mean that on the whole, many of those men are frustrated and unable to live out what they want to do, which is to be a different type of father.
You are listening to Life Matters here on Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor talking to Alistair Thompson, who's an emeritus professor in history at Monash University and one of the authors of a new book called Fathering an Australian History, just regaling us with stories of how dadding has changed over the last century. I've asked you how you dad, and maybe whether you've done things intentionally similarly or intentionally differently to the way you were raised by your own dad. Chris says, I just loved, cared for, engaged with, cleaned up and grew with my children while doing my best to work together with mum. I didn't see this through a gendered lens. And Chris says, thanks, Alistair. So history is, you know, by definition, looking back. But what do you see about the cultural fathering moment we're in right now, Alistair?
Yeah, look, on the one hand, it's the moment of Bandit, Bluey's dad, where dads can do everything. They're engaged, they've got a job, they raise their kids, they play with them. But at the same time, we know, for example, during COVID, and the afterword of the book looks at Bluey and COVID as two moments in sort of early 21st century family life and fathering. And we thought during COVID, when fathers as well as mothers were working at home, we thought that the load would shift and that it would be more equal and that fathers would play a more active and engaged role. And there's a lot of optimism in the early years of lockdowns in Melbourne, for example, that family dynamics and roles would shift significantly because of COVID. And we know now that that didn't happen, that even though fathers and mums were both working at home, fathers' work tended to be regarded as more important, more easier to shut off from family life and so on. And women continued, mothers continued to play the primary role and the emotional role, the thinking role about what are we got to do with the kids today and so on. So that's really tough. And I think one of the key things is what happens in those first few years. If we've learned one thing from this book, is that if a father takes a primary caring role for their kids in the first few years, then they'll continue to play an active and engaged role and won't become secondary dads. They'll be primary equal parents. But the wage system, the paid parental leave system, the fact that women take up paid parental leave much more than men, and that basically a lot of men, I mean, look in my own family, the fathers of my children's generation often can't afford to take more than a very small amount of paid parental leave because they just literally can't afford it. Until and unless you have a scheme a bit like, for example, in Scandinavia, where, you know, each parent can get 6 months of paid parental leave. If you don't take it as a father, you lose it as a family. And it's paid at your normal pay rate, so there's no disincentive. Then you see a lot of dads pushing prams in Copenhagen and Stockholm and so on. And that is a really transformative change.
Thanks for joining me today, Alistair. Alistair Thompson is a historian at Monash University, one of the authors of Fathering an Australian History. Up next, a dad who totally changed his philosophy around earning money when his daughter arrived. In our regular segment, My Two Cents, we ask those questions you'd rather not answer about money. You've heard how comedians, adventurers and musicians manage their money so far, as well as some of your favourites across the ABC like finance guru Alan Kohler and the people scientist Dr. Carl. Well, today, a comedian and former Triple J breakfast host on how family and becoming a dad has changed his financial goals.
I'm Matt O'Kine, and these days I earn a living by basically anything. Anything that's creative, I will try and figure out a way to make money from it. My last three purchases were a chicken katsu don from a local Japanese restaurant, a coffee this morning, and some beers at the footy last night. There's definitely a link between the beers and the crumbed chicken required the following day. The way my family talked about money growing up was fairly positively. I was given pocket money and I was allowed to do, I had a certain level of autonomy with that pocket money. And it was a fairly free and liberal approach to money, I think, in our household. I currently live in a home that I own, which is a exciting prospect. It was a lot of hard work to get there. For the majority of the beginning of my career, I barely had any money. And I was constantly living paycheck to paycheck and chasing invoices for the gigs that I'd done, etc. It was around about the time when, probably 2012, I had just won this award in the Melbourne International Comedy Festival. And I'd started doing some sort of much bigger touring. It was the first time I realized that actually the jobs will keep coming. And I remember looking at my bank account and suddenly I had $8,000 in my bank account. And then I remember the next year I got the job on Triple J and I was starting to host breakfast on Triple J. And it was the first time that I had a regular paycheck. And so about a year later, a year after I saw that $8,000 in my bank account, I remember again, I looked in my bank account and I had saved $50,000. And I thought, well, I can buy a house. I'd never ever thought that would be possible. I remember buying this two-bedroom apartment near where I grew up with my mum in Toowong in Brisbane. And it was a very sort of sentimental purchase. And they say don't buy with your heart, buy with your head or whatever. But for me, I wanted to buy a unit in Toowong. That's where we'd grown up. My mum had died when I was younger. And so I bought this two-bedroom apartment and I bought it sight unseen. I was actually living in Sydney at the time, but I just wanted to buy this place in Brisbane and it meant a lot to me. And by probably a year or two later, it had gone down in value by about 20%, I reckon. And I always knew that, well, worst comes to worst, I'm going to have a two-bedroom apartment in a part of the city that means a lot to me, and that's going to be more important than, you know, having something that's worth a lot. When my mum died, I was 12 years old, and there was a insurance payout, I think about $60,000 maybe or something at the time, and that went into a trust. And I didn't really even know what it was. I was 12 years old. I had no idea. So it just sat there. By the interest through the public trustee or whatever, it ended up making probably $2,000 to $3,000 a year. But it meant that when I was old enough to access it, I didn't think about it really, because I'd grown up without access to it or not thinking about it. So I'd never really... I knew it was there, but I didn't really know what to do with it. Every year I would take that sort of $2,000 or $3,000 and I would use it to, say, pay for accommodation during my first stint at the Melbourne Comedy Festival. So I would always try and put it into my career and invest it in my career. What I could have easily done, being 18 years old and with a big chunk of money sitting in a trust, is go to London and discover myself via the rave scene, you know. And I don't know why I never did that, but I'm thankful I didn't, because I could have just burned that money in a heartbeat. But I always just ended up... I think maybe there was something psychological, maybe knowing that my mum wouldn't have really loved me doing that. I think she would have been a little bit happy with me investing it in myself and my career and my future. And so those little pockets of investment that I made, being able to stay in an apartment in Melbourne for a month while I do my comedy festival and make no money and perform to barely anyone, that's what's ended up paying off tenfold. I'm really thankful that I've had that opportunity and that was somewhat of a silver lining that came out of a really unfortunate event. I've tried to work really hard to become content with how much I have, because realistically I have quite a lot. It's just so easy to look at other people around you and think, oh, I wish I had a bigger house, or I wish I had a better car, or I wish that I was doing bigger gigs. And I think if you get trapped in that mind cycle, you will never stop thinking that. You'll never actually just be happy with what you have. Because otherwise, if I got too hung up on the money thing, then I would you know, I would be wanting to do bigger gigs and wanting to do more shows and wanting to go travel more, to, you know, to tour more and do more of this. And that would take me away from what I actually really want to do right now. And that's just be at home with my family. I'm Matt O'Kine, and that's my two cents.
Money musings from family man and comedian Matt O'Kine on My Two Cents. Well, thank you for joining me on Life Buzz today. It has been a blast bringing you all your favourite parenting stories from the year for our special summer series. You'll hear a special best of from Beverly Wang tomorrow, and I'll be back here again next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.